Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Du Hirsu,
with a musical introduction by Brendan Lowe, our director of music. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Matt. Good morning. Happy Pride. My name is Kelly Ratliff, as Matt said. And unlike Greg, who kicked us off last week in support of the Restoration at the Table campaign, I've only been here a few years, nowhere close to the number of years Greg's been here. I discovered the table like many of you, just walking by. In my case, I'm lucky enough to only live a block and a half away, though if you ask my teenagers who occasionally travel with me, they'll attest to it being much farther. When I was asked to speak about why the table, why the campaign, I was crafting some rather clever talking points. I was being queued up to talk about economies of scale. And sadly, I'm not going to talk about finance or economics. Because this week in our kitchen table, one of our members asked a rather difficult and important question. She said something along the lines of, how can my family reconcile giving a gift for the long-term benefit of the church when there's so much uncertainty and so much wrong with the United Methodist Church's stance regarding LGBT. Did I mention I'm gay and she's straight? I've already signed my pledge card. I've already made my commitment. And yet I failed to ask this profoundly important question. So she gave us the gift of some really important dialogue at our KT. And after hearing from Karen, who leads our kitchen table, following up with Matt, I'm assured my gift to the table stays at the table. And as this church does the really hard work that lies ahead to reconcile what all means all here with the larger stance of the United Methodist Church, I know we'll consider many options, and I'm certain none of it will be passive. And even as we do that work, there's certainty that my gift, your gift, stays here. The whole answer is longer and more complicated, but that's my takeaway. And finally, actually, let me just say this. What better way for us to make a statement about our values and to ensure that we proceed with restoration and that the outside of this place shows the philosophy and spirit that exists inside? And then finally, as you consider all means all, this campaign most certainly includes something for everyone. I work in financial capacity at a big organization. Go Aggs. I've been carefully trained that raising money leads with program. Program first. Program needs to be compelling. Sexy even. Here, the table, they have the audacity to say, this campaign's about bathrooms and parking. Like, in a really big font. So, really, who cares about the larger discourse? We're talking bathrooms and parking here. Okay, kidding aside, I'm an enthusiastic supporter of these leaders, this church, and this campaign, and I hope you'll join me. Thank you.
You may be high, you may be low, you may be rich, and you may be poor. But when the Lord gets ready, girl, it's ready for you.
It's ready for you.
You gotta move.
You gotta move.
You gotta move.
For all who are led by the Spirit of God are children of God. For you did not receive a spirit of slavery to fall back into fear, but you've received a spirit of adoption. When we cry, Abba, Father, it is that very Spirit bearing witness with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, then heirs. Heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ. If, in fact, we suffer with him so that we may also be glorified with him. Amen.
What you do, there ain't nothing, there ain't nothing. you do
for love,
for love of your babies,
for love,
we're a planted family,
for love,
and it's alright,
for love,
it's alright,
for love,
yeah, it's alright.
It's really good to be with you, and I'm thankful for the opportunity to share this morning as part of the message. Today is Pentecost. It's the birthday of the church, and it's the day in which we commemorate when the Holy Spirit fell upon the women and men who were gathered together in the upper room, and that same Holy Spirit empowered them to carry out the mission that Jesus left them with, to continue the work that Jesus had been doing. That same Spirit that was with those women and men in the upper room is the same Spirit that is with us today. And so we are in continuity with our sisters and brothers in the past as we continue this ancient movement into the future. Birthdays are important days for us, but you know, my birthday is slightly bittersweet. And it is so because it was the day in which my biological mother gave me up for adoption on my birthday. And even today's a little bittersweet as well. Yesterday in Orange County, where I was with my wife, Bettina, it's right over there, we were in Mission Viejo. We had the memorial service for my mother, who passed away about a month ago. As Matt said, my name is Craig Brown, and I'm adopted. I want to tell you a little bit about my adoption story, because it really makes sense with this text that we heard from Romans chapter 8 this morning. But in order to tell that story, it requires me to tell you a little bit about this process we've been in as of late with my mother passing away. She died on May the 6th, just a little over a month ago. And this is my real mom, my adopted mom. And as I said, we had her memorial service yesterday. And a few days before she passed away, my mom and I had a very important conversation together. It was on a Friday, and she passed away on Monday. So I came to see my mom on Friday, and it was really the last time she was completely lucid. She really wasn't able to speak very much, but her eyes were open. She could see quite clearly that I was there, and she could engage with me at least non-verbally while I was talking with her. And of course, there's lots of things that you want to be able to say to your mother. As you know, her time to transition toward death is coming near. And so I told my mom how much I thanked her for her presence, for her activity in my life, for the love she poured into me as her child. I thanked her for the contribution she made to my education and my life. My mother is one of six siblings, and out of all of those siblings and all of their children and grandchildren, nieces, nephews, all of that, I'm the only one that ever went to college. And I was able to do so because my mother and father paid the entire cost for me to go to college and the entire cost for me to go to seminary. That's a gift that not many of my colleagues have in ministry. Many of them are burdened by tons of educational debt in order to advance in their life and their career. And so I was incredibly thankful for my mother and father in making that investment in me. But the most important part of our conversation together on that Friday morning had to do with forgiveness. And let me explain. Back in 1997, my mother and father divorced after 39 years of marriage. And when they divorced back in 1997, it was acrimonious, to say the least. And as they went through that process, my father not only experienced divorcing himself from my mother, but he also experienced divorcing himself from me. He felt that I had completely taken my mother's side in their divorce, and so not only did I lose the marriage of my mother and father as a child, but I also lost my father in the process. I was always suspect that in the part of the divorce proceedings that my mother may have said or done something that would cause my father to believe that I had forsaken him, but I never really could know that for sure. Fast forward 20 plus years, in March of 2017, my mother had a catastrophic stroke. She was living independently at home by herself, and so she had a stroke at home alone, which is really the worst way you could possibly have a stroke if you're going to have one, and she was unattended for hours before she was discovered and then taken to the hospital. And so after the stroke, it became apparent that my mom was always now going to need constant 24/7 care, and me being the only child, that responsibility fell to me. So I went to my mom's house and had to go through the process of cleaning out everything in her house, all of her furniture, all of her papers. And so I had to sort through everything, trying to decide what to keep and what not to keep. And in the process of doing so, I came across all of the paperwork related to their divorce. Read through all the depositions, read through all the testimony, everything that was there. And the suspicion that I had for many, many years was confirmed. My mother had said things in those proceedings that misrepresented my relationship with my father. And it was partially because of that, not entirely, but partially, that the relationship I had with my father came to an end. And so over the last 2 years, as I've been taking care of my mother, first in San Diego and then moving her here to Sacramento last year, I've been sitting on this resentment, this animosity that I've had toward her for breaking this relationship that I had with my father. And so it was important before she died that I have a conversation with her about it. And so on that Friday, before she passed away, I sat at her bedside. I thanked her for all those things that I had already talked about. But remember, forgiveness was the important part of that conversation. I knew I needed to forgive my mother for that. Now, I thought that I needed to internalize that forgiveness. In other words, do the forgiving work inside and then say to her, "You're forgiven," as evidence of that. And to be honest with you, that whole thought process just really revealed that I was full of crap, all right? That what happened here is this, is that I didn't forgive my mother until I sat at her bedside and I said, "Mom, I forgive you for doing what you did." And I asked her if she could forgive me as a son. And I have to tell you that as soon as I uttered the words, I experienced the forgiveness. It wasn't until I said the words that did it actually happen. And it was one of the most transformational experiences of my life, when the animosity and the anger and the bitterness that I had harbored toward my mom about what she did in the divorce with my father, that evaporated immediately. And in that moment, all I felt was just love for my mother. And so during the last few days of her life, that was the way I interacted with her. I loved her in a way that I had never loved her before. I'm going to come back to this story a little bit later, but it has everything to do with adoption. Because adoption means certain things, and adoption does certain things. And that's what I want to talk with you about today. I was born on February the 6th, 1968. And when I was born, my biological mother had already made a decision to give me up for adoption. And she did. And when she gave me up for adoption, there were not adoptive parents ready for me, and so I became a ward of the County of Los Angeles. And I lived with a foster family all the way from February the 6th up until April 15th of that same year. And it was on that day that my mother and father took me home for the first time. Fast forward a little while later, maybe about a year or so later, they were able to finalize my adoption at court. And this is a picture taken of my mother and father the day they signed all the court papers and the judge ruled that I would be their child. And so this is how I grew up. I grew up as an adopted only child. So April the 15th is an important day in my life. It was the day that I went home with my parents. It continues to be an important day in my life because my wife is a CPA, and so we live and die by April 15th. April 15th is also an important day because in 1981, on April the 15th, when I was 13 years old, I was baptized and became a Christian. And so the notion of being adopted is a powerful one for me. It was April the 15th, the day I went home. April 15th was the day I was baptized. I was baptized here. This is the Methodist church that I was baptized in Oklahoma. That's me standing in front of the church. Matt saw this picture, and he didn't know who that guy was. And I go, "Dude, that's me. I weighed a couple more pounds back then. And this was an important place for me, an important time for me. I became a Christian because five schoolmates at school at the age of 13 led me to faith in Christ. I never went to church as a child. I didn't know anything about Jesus until those schoolmates told me about him, and I prayed and asked Christ to come into my life, and then I was baptized. I went to the Methodist church because that's where they all went, and I'm still here to this day, still United Methodist. I grew up on a street in Buena Park, California, where there were about 13 of us that lived on this street about a block away from Knott's Berry Farm. And out of the 13 children who lived on that street, 10 of us were all adopted. And so I thought that being adopted was normal. Like, everybody's adopted. Isn't everybody adopted? How many of you in this room today are adopted in any way? Yeah, okay, there's three of you. Okay, good. Now, there's all sorts of different ways people are adopted. But when I hear this text from Romans chapter 8, it resonates with me powerfully. And so I want to talk with you about what adoption means. Now, first, for me, it meant that I had to recognize that I was abandoned. That I was abandoned. Now, people who experience adoption, there's all sorts of different ways we do that now with so many different models of what families look like. But for me, being abandoned was the beginning of my adoption story. I knew there was a person somewhere at some point in time that decided that they were going to leave me. They were not going to keep me. They were going to give me away to somebody else. And so it was important that I wrestled with what it meant to be abandoned as a young child. When Paul writes this letter to the church in Rome, he's writing it to a divided community. Let me explain real quickly. The Christian movement started in the city of Rome early on, and it was a movement made up of Jews who had come to believe in Jesus as the Messiah, and then eventually there were Gentiles or Romans that became a part of that congregation as well. So it was a mixture of Jews and Gentiles together in this Christian community. Well, eventually there was a fire in the city of Rome. The emperor was incredibly upset about it, blamed the Jews for the fire, as we've been doing for 2,000 years, blaming the Jews for everything that goes wrong. And so the emperor expelled the Jews from the city of Rome. He threw them out. And so the Jews were forced to relocate around the world. You may have heard of a couple of these Jews. This happened to Aquila and Priscilla that we read about in the book of Acts and in Paul's other letters. This is a married couple, great leaders in the church, that were thrown out of the city of Rome. So now this church that was Jew and Gentile together is now just Gentile. And so without the Jewish influence in that congregation, the Gentiles had the whole church to themselves. So they started having ham sandwich potlucks and eating meat offered to idols. They started doing all these things that they would never have been able allowed to do if Jews were in their community as well. Well, sure enough, like all things, the emperor dies. The Jews come back to Rome, only to find the church that was once theirs is now completely different. And the landscape is completely changed. And so the argument begins to ensue. Who are the real children of God? The Jews, the children of Abraham, or the Gentiles? And it creates this huge conflict in the church. And that's why Paul writes this letter to them, to deal with their conflict. The Jews felt abandoned, like they lost their whole community. The Gentiles, they had felt abandoned, because aren't God's chosen people the Jews? So where do all the Gentiles fit in? And so Paul uses this beautiful image of adoption. I had to reckon with what it meant to be abandoned in my context when my own children were born. When my son David was born, Bettina and I brought him home from the hospital, and I remember that very first night I was looking at him on his changing table, and I looked at Bettina and I said, so when does someone from the hospital come and pick this child up? Now, I was making a joke, but hiding beneath it was the sense of what do I do with this life? What is this that's happened to me? It uncovered a whole set of issues I had to wrestle with. Decided I needed to go see a therapist. I spent months in therapy trying to understand this anxiety I had about becoming a parent, because it was something that was so unnatural to me. And in that process, I discovered that I had these feelings of being abandoned as a child, and I needed to wrestle with those and come to grips with them. That story has a beautiful conclusion because later on I met my biological mother in San Diego, of all places, where I happened to live. Her name is Ray Hurtica, a wonderful young woman. When she was 18 years old, she met a young man in the Coast Guard, and they knew each other for a day. And she turned up being pregnant. And as a young 18-year-old woman, I can't even imagine what this was like. I mean, hearing the story from her really opened my eyes, because while I had gone through this whole process of dealing with what it meant to be abandoned, all of a sudden I had this empathy. It was like, I can't even imagine what it's like to be 18 years old in 1968. This is 4 years before Roe v. Wade. And the options that she had to deal with and face were overwhelming. And she made a very, very difficult decision. And that was to give me up for adoption, believing that other people could raise me better than she ever could. She's a lovely woman. Her parents have an interesting story. Her father was Roman Catholic, and her mother was Jewish. And they're immigrants from Eastern Europe. And so when her mother and father were married, they had to compromise between Judaism and Catholicism, and so they decided to be Methodist. So Ray grew up as a young woman in a Methodist church. The good news for me is that since Ray's mother is Jewish, and that would make Ray herself Jewish, which makes me Jewish, because the Jewish lineage is passed through the maternal line. I joke with people sometimes, I have two of my bases covered, Christian and Jewish. I just need to find some Islam in there somewhere, and I've got all monotheistic religions nailed. I had to deal with what it meant to be abandoned, but on the flip side, I had to deal with what it meant to be chosen. What it means to be chosen. It's hard for Methodists to wrap their arms around being chosen. We talk about free will a lot. It's the choice that makes us chosen. Paul, in this passage from Romans 8, says that there's the Spirit of God that makes us adopted. So imagine Paul trying to talk to these Jews and these Greeks in this Roman church, trying to explain to them how they're supposed to get along together. And he tells them, he says, look, you're adopted. How do you think we're all part of a family together? What makes us part of the family isn't our flesh and blood. What makes us part of the family is this unconditional love of God that's extended to all of us and adopts all of us into that family. Adoption is a metaphor used by Paul. It explains how Gentiles become a part of the family. I have to tell you, in my case, being chosen is an interesting dynamic. I'm an adopted only child. That is the perfect recipe for being a spoilt brat, which for most of my childhood I was. You'll have to ask my wife afterwards if I still am. What I would suggest to you is this, is that as much as you deal with what it means to be abandoned, in my case, as an adopted child, it also means you have to deal with what it's like to be chosen. My parents shopped for me and bought me and picked me. That's a totally different type of experience. But it also means we're part of a family as an adopted child. Paul says that we're fellow heirs with Jesus Christ. So he's telling these Jews and these Romans in conflict with each other that you're heirs together. Not slaves, not just free, but heirs. It's a different type of relationship. You know, my mother and my father, they loved me desperately. And what Ray Hurtica, my biological mother, could not do as that young 18-year-old woman, my mother and father did. My mom was a very crafty person. She used to oil paint. I have some of her paintings hanging in my house. All sorts of wonderful things. She worked with special ed students, as we call them back in the 1970s, as a teacher's aide. And I used to go to work with her during the summer, working with those young children dealing with physical and emotional issues in their life and challenges. It was a powerful experience for me. My dad was a general contractor, a really hard worker, and one of the things he did is he flipped houses in South Central Los Angeles, these old 1920, 30 Victorian and arts and crafts homes. He flipped those houses and then sold them. And the people he sold them to were these immigrants who were moving into South Los Angeles in the 1970s, coming from a country you may have heard of called Mexico. As the African-American community was moving out of South Central LA, the Hispanic community was moving in, my father had a hand in that. He flipped those houses and sold them, and since those Hispanic families had no capacity to go to a bank to get a loan to buy houses, my dad and his business partner, Dave Ruiz, decided the best thing they could do would be to loan the money themselves to those families to buy those houses, and so they lent the money to them at about half the going mortgage rate, so those families could afford to live in those homes and have two or three or four generations of people living in those houses. My dad taught me that. My mom just died a month ago, and I inherited her entire estate. So I have a small taste of the bittersweet notion of inheritance. Remember, Paul says that we're heirs? In order for there to be an inheritance, brothers and sisters, someone has to die. And that has to do with what adoption does for us. First and foremost, adoption saves us. I want you to be patient with the Apostle Paul. He gets a bad rap these days. Remember, the poor guy did all of his writing 2,000 years ago in a patriarchal world, and he wrote every single one of his letters before even one of the Gospels was written. So give the guy a break. He frames this story around being a son in Romans chapter 8. So bear with me in the patriarchal language for a minute. Because you see, it was sons who received inheritances. It was sons who received the privilege and honor of the name of the family. It was sons who received all of this from their own families. And what Paul wants to say is that being a son is critical because it's adoption that takes us from being abandoned to belonging. It makes us brothers and sisters. It's the way we move from one world to the other world. Then he says a couple of important words here. He says, we cry out to God as Abba, Father. You've heard this before? The word Abba is an Aramaic word, and it's a word for father, but it's the term of affection usually used by a child for their parent. The rough equivalent in English would be daddy. It's not quite close enough. Abba is the word everyone in the Jewish community in that Roman church would have understood. And then he says, Abba, Father. Do you see how he's being redundant? Abba, which means father, and then father, meaning father. That's the Greek word pater. So when he says we call out to God as Abba, Father, do you hear what he's telling the Greeks and the Jews? We all cry out to the same God, Abba, Father. It's that relationship that saves us. It's that relationship that gives us wholeness. It's the sense of belonging to God as children and as heirs, as daughters and as sons. If there could be anything I could possibly communicate to the Christian community, it would be this, is that we're adopted. We are not adherents. We're a relationship with God and each other framed in a religion. We keep thinking that Christianity is some kind of form or institution or system or way of thought. Brothers and sisters, no, we're adopted. We're part of a family together. And if we're adopted, then that means each one of us has received unconditional love. See, that we all like to receive unconditional love. The problem with unconditional love for all of us is that in order to receive it, we must surrender all of our rights and entitlements to it. Because if it is a right we have or an entitlement we have, it's not unconditional. That means I've done something for it. I've earned it. I'm entitled to it. Being loved unconditionally is a recognition that without God, we would be lost. It's just love. It saves you, it humbles you, and transforms your life. I heard it said some time ago that it's better to be humble than to be humbled. Would you agree? I think we all would. You see, when we realize that we're adopted by God and that we have no rights other than God's love, we're changed. We don't regard anyone according to a human point of view anymore. We're all children. And Jesus reinforces the same thing Paul said. Paul says, we're all adopted. It's the only way we become a part of God's household. What did Jesus tell us? Unless you become like one of these children, you cannot enter the kingdom of God. Does it make sense? Do the wheels begin to turn? I'll ask you again, how many of you in this room are adopted? We're getting there. Not only does it save you, it humbles you, but lastly, it perfects you. Adoption perfects you. You know, we all live on this razor of abandonment and love. How many things have we done in our life because we were afraid to lose love? How many things have we done in our lives because we wanted to earn love? We live on this razor between abandonment and love all the time. And it's in that tension, it's in that place that we usually hold in our life that the perfecting grace of God is at work, transforming us and saving us. What did Paul say in verse 17? We are heirs with God and fellow heirs with Christ, if indeed we suffer with him, so that we may be glorified with him. Let me explain what I mean by being perfected by finishing the story of my mom's death. I came on that Friday, which was the Friday before the Monday in which my mom died about a month ago. And we got a phone call early the next day on Saturday morning that my mom had lost her ability to swallow. And that typically means a person's kind of getting close to the end of their life. So Bettina and my son David and I rushed over to the house to see how she was doing. She was in a boarding care because she required 24/7 care. So we rushed over there. And sure enough, during that day, I did all the things you're supposed to do. I mean, as a pastor, I've been with families time and time and time again while they've been with a dying relative. And so I know everything in the playbook. You need to say goodbye. You need to tell the person it's okay to go. You need to tell them it's all right. You need to get their children to say so, their relatives to say so, their friends to say so. I ran every play in the book you're supposed to run. I got friends on the phone to tell my mom goodbye. I got her sister on the phone. Everything. But after Saturday morning, she just continued to linger. She just would not let go. And her breathing just continued to be labored, and I could tell she was struggling. So fast forward to Monday morning. It's now 2 days later, and she's still struggling. I decide that what I need to do is write a letter. And the letter I decide to write is to my dad. And so I write my father a letter. I tell my mom, my dad, everything happening with my mom, everything that's going on, and the pain that she's been in. And then I also tell my dad that even though I haven't seen him in 20 years, I talk about him all the time. I tell my children about the great things he taught me, his presence in my life, the great contributions he made. I also told him that I tell my children as well not to make the same mistake he made, which was divorce his own son. My father has seen his granddaughter one time when she was 3 months old. I told him that I would ensure that I would never make the mistake he made, that there is absolutely nothing my children could ever do that would make me not be their father and not love them unconditionally. And after I told him all of that, I told him that I forgave him. I forgave him for his failures, and I asked him to forgive me for mine. I finished writing the letter. I got up from where I was sitting in my mom's room at her bedside. I went in and used the restroom, and I came back. And I told my mom in her bed everything that I had just said to my father in that letter. The hospice nurse arrived just at the same time, walked in the room, looked at my mom. I looked up at the hospice nurse, and I just said, I don't know why my mom is hanging on. I just want her to die well. And we both looked down at my mother, and she breathed her last. Not even 5 minutes after I told her what I said to my father. You see, even in her death and suffering, and even a little bit of my own, God saved me. God humbled me. God perfected me. All my contempt, anger, and pain was healed, all of it. And God perfected me in that moment. This is adoption. It is to belong. To be God's child. Broken. Sobbing. Hurting. Now, I know more than most that only God is the perfect parent. So I give thanks to God for for Ray, my biological mother. She is a gift, and I'm thankful for her choice to give me up for adoption. I give thanks to God for my mother and father for all their love and care over these years. And because of that, I give thanks to God for my own family. Here they are. And the love we share together. I give thanks to God for the church and the family that it has become to me. But most of all, I give thanks to God, Abba, Father, Mother, Parent. Without all of these, I would not be here today. Maybe not anywhere today. So what a blessing it is to be part of a family forever. Amen.
We are soaked in all the grace that we've been given, unchained from all that we have done. Your mercy's rising like the sun on the horizon, and we're coming home. Oh, you know that we're coming home.